Behind Lord John, the first beam of sunlight struck like a golden lance across the world's rim. It was dawn in Belgium. Clouds still heaped in the west, but over the crossroads at Quatre Bras, and above a stream just north of Fleurus, the sky was clear as glass. Larks tumbled in song above the roads, where 338,000 men, in the armies of Prussia, Britain, and France, converged on death.
"God save Ireland!"
Harper reined in at Quatre Bras. In front of him, and smeared across the southern sky, was the smoke of thousands of campfires. The smoke betrayed an army encamped. The French troops were hidden by the folds of ground and by the woods and high crops, but the smoke was evidence enough that thousands of men had closed on Flan in the night to support the battalion of French skirmishers who had been balked the previous evening. Closer to Sharp and Harper, around the crossroads of Quatre Bras, more men had gathered, all of them Dutch Belgians of the Prince of Orange's corps. There was a smattering of musket fire from far beyond the stream, evidence that the rival picket lines of skirmishers were bidding each other a lethal good morning. The Baron Rebec, waiting with a group of the prince's aides at the crossroads, seemed relieved to see Sharp.
"We're concentrating the corps here instead of at Nivelles."
"Quite right, too," Sharp said fervently.
Rebec unfolded a sketch map he had made.
"The French are in Farn, and we're holding all the farms beyond the stream, except this one by the ford. We'll only garrison that if we're forced back to it."
"I'd garrison it now," Sharp recommended.
"Not enough men."
Rebec folded his map.
"So far only 8,000 infantry have arrived, with 16 guns and no cavalry."
Sharp cast a professional eye at the smoke of the French cooking fires.
"They've got 20,000, Rebec."
"I was hoping you wouldn't tell me that."
Rebec, accepting Sharp's experienced estimate without question, smiled grimly.
"So, if I can make a suggestion..."
"My dear Sharp, anything."
"Tell our skirmishers to hold their fire. We don't want to provoke the crapauds into nastiness, do we?"
There was no sense in inviting battle from a much stronger enemy. It was better to delay any fighting in the hope of more Allied troops arriving to even the numbers who faced each other south of Fran. The sky above Quatre Bras was dirtied by the campfires, but to the east the rising sun betrayed a much vaster quantity of rising wood smoke. That larger smear in the sky showed where the Prussian army faced the main force of the French, and where the day's real battle would be fought. The French would be trying to defeat the Prussians before the British and Dutch could come to their aid, while the Prussians, to be certain of victory, needed Wellington's troops to march from Quatre Bras and assault the Emperor's left flank. But that rescue mission had been stopped dead by the presence of the 20,000 French men encamped in Fran, who had been sent by the Emperor to make sure that the Allied armies did not combine. All that the French needed to do was to take the crossroads at Quatre Bras. Sharp reckoned it could not take the enemy longer than an hour to overrun the fragile line of Dutch-Belgian troops, and in one further hour they could have fortified the crossroads to make them impassable to the British. The French were thus 1 hour from victory, just 1 hour from separating the Allied armies. Yet, as the sun climbed higher, and as the smoke of the dying fires thinned, the French made no move to advance on the crossroads. They did not even follow the retreating Dutch skirmishers, but seemed content to let the morning's skirmish die to nothing. Sharp looked to the north and west, searching for the telltale drifts of dust that would speak of reinforcements hurrying towards the threatened crossroads. No dust showed above the roads yet, evidence that the French had plenty of time to make their attack. The Prince of Orange arrived 3 hours after dawn, excited at the prospect of action.
"Morning, Sharp. A bright one, isn't it? Rebec, all well?"
Rebec attempted to tell the prince how his troops were deployed, but the prince was too restless merely to listen.
"Show me, Rebec, show me. Let's go for a gallop, all of us."
He gestured to his whole staff, who dutifully fell in behind Rebec and the prince, as they spurred away from the crossroads towards the south. The prince waved happily at a party of soldiers who drew water from the stream, then twisted in his saddle to shout at Sharp.
I expected to see you at the ball last night. Sharp?
I arrived very late, sir.
Did you dance?
Regrettably not, sir.
Nor me. Duty called.
The prince galloped past the deserted Gemiancourt farm, through a bivouacked Dutch brigade, and did not rein in till he'd passed the forward Dutch pickets and could see clear down the paved highway into the village of Fern. There had to be some enemy skirmishers close by, yet the prince blithely ignored their threat. His staff officers waited a few yards to the rear as the young man stared towards the enemy encampment.
Sharp!
Sharp walked his horse forward.
Sir? How many of the devils are facing us, would you say?
Very few enemy troops were actually in sight. A battery of guns stood at the edge of the village. Some cavalry horses stood unsaddled in the street beyond. And a battalion of infantry was bivouacked in a field to the right of the guns, but otherwise the enemy was hidden, and so Sharp stuck with his earlier estimate.
20,000, sir.
The prince nodded.
Just what I'd say. Splendid.
He smiled genially at Sharp.
And just when are you going to appear in a Dutch uniform?
Sharp was taken aback.
Soon, sir.
Soon? I've been requesting that small courtesy for weeks. I want to see you in proper uniform today, Sharp. Today.
The prince shook an admonishing finger at the rifleman, then took out his telescope to stare at the battery of French guns. It was hard to see what caliber the cannon were, for the air was already hot enough to shimmer and blur the details of the far guns.
It's going to be a hot day,
the prince complained. His yellowish skin glistened with sweat. He was in a blue uniform coat that was thickly encrusted with gold loops and edged with black astrakhan fur. At his hip hung a massively heavy sabre with an ivory hilt. The prince's vanity had made him dress for a winter's campaign on what threatened to be the summer's hottest day yet. The sultry air pressed heavily on the men who guarded the farms that marked the perimeter of the Dutch position. If that perimeter was broken, there was still the Gemiancourt farm by the ford, which could be an anchor to a defensive line. But once Gemiancourt was captured, there was nothing between the French and the crossroads. Sharp prayed that the French would go on waiting, and that the British troops, who were marching desperately to reinforce the outnumbered defenders at Quatre Bras, reached the crossroads in time. By 8 o'clock, the French had still not attacked. At 9 o'clock, the Dutch troops still waited. At 10, the Duke of Wellington reached the crossroads, and, content that nothing yet threatened the Dutch troops, galloped eastwards to find the Prussians. The morning inched onwards. It seemed impossible that the French still hesitated. At intervals, an enemy horseman might appear at the edge of the village, to gaze through a spyglass at the Dutch positions. But no attacks followed such reconnaissances. No skirmishers wormed their way through the fields, and no cannon crashed shell or round shot at the fragile Dutch lines. At midday, the French still waited. The heat was now oppressive. The western clouds had thickened, and the old wounds in Sharp's leg and shoulder began to ache, a sure prophecy of rain. He lunched with the Prince of Orange's staff in the remains of an orchard behind the farm at the crossroads. Harper, of whose status none of the Dutch was quite certain, shared the princely cold chicken, hard-boiled eggs, and red wine. The prince, momentarily forgetting his orders for Sharp to change into Dutch uniform, dominated the luncheon conversation as he eagerly expressed his wish that the French would attack before the Duke returned from his meeting with the Prussians. For then the prince could defeat the enemy with only the help of his faithful Dutch troops. The prince dreamed of a great Netherlands victory with himself as its hero. He saw pliant girls offering him the laurels of victory before they fainted before his conquering feet. He could not wait to begin such a triumph, and prayed that the French would offer him the chance of glory before the arrival of any British reinforcements. And in the early afternoon, and before the hurrying British reinforcements could reach the crossroads, the prince's wish was granted. An enemy cannon banged its signal, and the French at last were advancing to battle.
Was that a gun? I swear that was a gun. Would you say that was a gun, Vine?
Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Ford, commanding officer of the Prince of Wales' own volunteers, twisted in his saddle and stared anxiously at his senior major, who, because he was deaf, had heard nothing. Major Vine, thus unable to confirm or deny the sound which had so alarmed his colonel, merely offered a bad-tempered scowl as a reply. So Colonel Ford looked past him to seek the opinion of the captain of his light company.
"Was that a gun, Dalimore? Would you say that was a gun?"
Dalimore, his head aching with hangover, still wore his white dancing breeches and buckled shoes from the night before. He did not want to speak to anyone, let alone Ford, but he made an effort and confirmed that the colonel had indeed heard a cannon's report, but very far away, and with its sound much muted by the humid air.
"We're going to be late," Ford worried.
Just at this moment, Dalimore did not care how late they would be. He just wanted to lie down somewhere very dark and very cool and very silent. He wished the colonel would go away, but he knew Ford would keep pestering until he received some reassurance.
"The brigade marched on time, sir," he told the worried Ford, "and no one can expect more of us."
"There's another gun. Do you hear it, Vine? There. Oh, and another. Upon my soul, Dalimore, but it's begun. It's begun indeed."
Ford's eyes, behind their small, thick spectacles, betrayed excited alarm. Ford was a decent man and a kind one, but he had a worrying nervousness that aggravated Dalimore's patience. The colonel fretted about the opinions of senior officers, the diligence of his junior officers, and the loyalty of his non-commissioned officers. He worried about the spare ammunition, about the ability of the men to hear orders in battle, and about the morality of the wives who followed the marching column like a gypsy rabble. He agonized about losing his spectacles, for Ford was as short-sighted as a mole, and he worried about losing his battalion's colors, and about losing his hair. He was ever anxious about the weather, and when he could think of nothing else to be anxious about, he became worried that he must have forgotten something important that should have been causing him worry. The ever-anxious Ford had been appointed to replace Major Richard Sharp as commanding officer of the battalion, which of itself was cause for the colonel to worry, for Joseph Ford was keenly aware that the rifleman had been a most competent and experienced soldier. Nor did it help Ford that many of his junior officers and a good third of his rankers had seen far more fighting than he had himself. Ford had been appointed to the battalion in the dying weeks of the last war, and he'd only experienced a few skirmishes. Yet now he must lead the Prince of Wales's own volunteers against the Emperor's field army, a realization that naturally occasioned Ford constant trepidation. "But at least," he comforted his officers, "it's a veteran battalion."
"It is that, Colonel, it is that."
Major Vine, a small, strutting, dark-eyed, bad-tempered stoot of a man, always agreed with the Colonel, when he managed to hear what the Colonel had actually said. Ford, distrusting such easy agreement, would seek support for his views from the more experienced officers of the battalion. But those officers, such as Peter Dalimore, doubted whether the Prince of Wales's own volunteers could truthfully be called a veteran battalion. A third of its men were new recruits, who had seen no fighting. Almost another third had seen as little as the colonel, while only the rest, like Dalimore, had actually faced a French army in open battle. Still, that experienced third was the battalion's backbone, the men whose voices would stiffen the ranks and give the colonel the victory he needed in his opening engagement. And that was all Dalimore prayed for at this moment, that Ford would learn success fast, and thus calm his worried fears. Dalimore also prayed for a swift and overwhelming victory for himself. He wanted to return to England, where a bride and a house and a secure civilian future waited for him. His bride was called Anne Nickerson, the daughter of an Essex landowner, whose reluctant consent to an army marriage had turned to wholehearted approval when Peter Dalimore had put up his captaincy for sale. Then, just as Dalimore was about to sell his commission and retire to one of his prospective father-in-law's farms, Napoleon had returned to France. Colonel Ford, worried that he was losing his veteran captain of skirmishers, had begged Dalimore to stay for the impending campaign, and implicit in the colonel's plea was a promise that D'Alembert would receive the next vacant majority in the battalion. That enticement was sufficient. The captaincy would sell for £1,500, which was a good enough fortune for any young man contemplating marriage. But a majority would fetch £2,600, and so D'Alembert, with some misgivings, but reassured by the prospect of a fine marriage portion, had agreed to Ford's request. Now, ahead of D'Alembert, the gunfire rumbled like dull thunder, to remind him that the £2,600 must be earned the hard way. D'Alembert, contemplating how much happiness he now stood to lose, shivered with a premonition, then told himself that he had always feared the worst before every battle. Joseph Ford, frightened because he was about to fight his first real battle, worried that either he or his men might not do their duty, and, as ever, when worry overwhelmed him, he snatched off his spectacles and polished their lenses on his sash. He believed that such a commonplace action expressed a careless insouciance, whereas it really betrayed his fretting nervousness. Yet, this day, as they marched towards the gunfire, the men of the Prince of Wales's own volunteers were oblivious of their colonel's fears. They trudged on, breathing the dust of the dry summer road that had been shuffled up by the boots ahead. And they wondered if there would be an issue of rum before the fighting began, or whether they would be too late for the fighting and would instead be billeted in some soft Belgian village, where the girls would flirt and the food would be plentiful.
"It's sounding bad."
Private Charlie Weller spoke of the distant gunfire, which did not really sound so very awful yet, but Weller was feeling a flicker of nervousness and wanted the relief of conversation.
"We've heard worse than that, Charlie,"
Daniel Hagman, the oldest man in the light company, said, but he spoke tiredly, dutifully, unthinkingly. Hagman was a kind man who recognized Charlie Weller's apprehension, but the day was too hot, the sun too fierce, and the dust too parching for kindness to have much of a chance. Major Vine curbed his horse to watch the 10 companies march past. He snapped at the men to pick up their feet and straighten their shoulders. They took no notice. They did not like Vine, recognizing that the Major despised them as a lumpen, dull, ugly mass. But the men themselves knew better. They were Wellington's infantry, the finest of the best, and they were marching east and south to where a pall of gun smoke was forming like a dark cloud over a far crossroads, and to where the guns cleared their throats to beckon men to battle. The French attack began with a cannonade which punched billows of grey-black smoke into the hazing, dancing air above the village of Fran. The Prince of Orange, unable to resist the lure of danger, galloped from the crossroads to be with those troops closest to the enemy, and the Prince's staff, their luncheon brutally interrupted by the French gunfire, hurried after him. Sharp was among the staff officers who trotted their horses down the Charleroi Road, past the Gemioncourt farm by the ford, and so on up the shallow hill until they reached the infantry brigade which guarded against any frontal attack up the high road. The French guns were firing at the flanks of the Prince's position, aiming at the farmhouses to east and west. Nothing seemed to be moving on the road itself, though Sharp supposed the French must have some skirmishers concealed in the fields of Long Rye.
"They'll be coming straight up the middle, won't they?"
Sharp turned to see that Harper had joined him.
"I thought you were staying well away from any danger."
"What danger, for God's sake? No one's firing at us now."
Harper had rescued the cold carcass of a roast chicken from the Prince's interrupted lunch, and now tossed Sharp a leg.
"They look bloody strange, don't they?"
He was referring to the brigade of Dutch-Belgian infantry that was spread in four ranks either side of the road to block a direct attack from Fran. The strangeness lay in the men's uniforms, which were the standard French infantry uniforms. Only the eagle badge on their shakos had been changed, replaced by a W for King William of the Netherlands. But otherwise the Dutch-Belgians were dressed exactly like the men they were doubtless about to fight.
"You know what to do?"
the prince asked the brigade commander, in his native French.
If we can't hold them, sir, we'll fall back on Gemiancourt.
Exactly.
The farm by the ford was the last battalion before the vital crossroads. Loopholes had already been made in the stone walls of Gemiancourt's huge barns, which, like the buildings of so many of the isolated farms in the Low Countries, were joined together and protected by a high stone wall, making the whole farm into a massively strong fortress.
"Something's stirring, eh?"
The prince, reverting to English, was elated by an outburst of musket fire which sounded from somewhere in front of the Dutch line. The musketry was not the huge eruptions of platoon fire, but rather the smaller, sporadic snapping of skirmishes, which betrayed that the French voltigeurs were closing on the Dutch light troops, but both sets of skirmishers were well hidden from the prince and his staff by the tall crops.
"Funny to hear that sound again, isn't it?"
Harper commented dryly.
"Did you miss it?"
"Never thought I would," the Irishman said sadly, "but I did."
Sharp remembered the familiar skill with which he had killed the French lieutenant in this very rye field.
"It's the thing we're good at, Patrick. Maybe we're doomed to be soldiers forever.
You, maybe, but not me. I have a tavern and a horse-thieving trade to keep me busy."
Harper frowned at the Belgians in their French uniforms.
"Do you think these buggers will fight?"
"They bloody better,"
Sharp said grimly. The brigade, with its supporting artillery, was all that lay between the French and victory. The Dutch Belgians certainly looked prepared to fight. They'd trampled down the rye ahead of their line to make a killing ground some 60 yards deep, and, judging by the sound of their musketry, the Dutch Belgian skirmishers were fighting with a brisk energy. The two wings of the Dutch Belgian brigade stretched a half mile on either side of the highway, while, athwart the road itself, was a battery of 6 Dutch 9-pounder cannons. The gunners had parked their limbers and ammunition wagons in the field behind Sharp. The guns were loaded, their port fires smoking gently in readiness for the French.
"Four-legged bastards, off to the right," Harper said warningly.
And Sharp turned to see a troop of enemy cavalry trotting towards the Dutch right flank. The horsemen were green-coated lancers with high helmets, topped with forward-sweeping black plumes. They were still a good distance off, at least a half mile, and were not yet any threat to the prince's troops. The prince had positioned himself just behind the 6 guns of the Dutch battery. Rebec, staying close to his master, gravely inspected one of the cannon, almost as if he had never seen such an object before. Then, suddenly afflicted by hay fever, he sneezed. The prince muttered, "Bless you," then stood in his stirrups to gaze at the lancers through a telescope. The French cannons abruptly ceased fire. The only sounds now were the intermittent crackle of the skirmishers' muskets and the ragged music of a Dutch band. The prince's horse whinnied. Rebecca's pawed at the trampled rye stalks. This was the silence before battle.
"Stand ready."
The prince, unable to bear the quiet, spurred his horse towards the closest Belgian battalion.
"You'll see the enemy infantry soon," he shouted at the men. "A few volleys will see them off, so stand firm."
"The bloody gunners are just changing their aim," Harper said scathingly after Sharp had translated the prince's words.
"Probably," Sharp said. He patted his horse's neck. Rebecca suddenly sneezed again, and, as if it had been a word of command, the French batteries resumed their cannonade. Harper had been right. They had merely been changing their aim, and now the French gunners concentrated their shots at the center of the field. There were more enemy guns firing than before. Sharp counted 24 gouts of smoke in the first salvo. The French gunners were masked by the rye, but some of their balls struck home in the waiting Dutch battalions. One round shot bounced cleanly between two of the Dutch guns and somehow missed every single horseman surrounding the prince. The artillery colonel asked for permission to return the fire, but the prince ordered him to wait till the enemy infantry was in sight. The French batteries fired another volley. Sharp saw the blossoming smoke of fraction before the sound punched the air. More men were struck in the Dutch battalions, but most balls went overhead, for the French gunners were firing a fraction too high. Sharp saw one cannonball's passage marked by the flickering of the rye stalks in a darkening line that shot at extraordinary speed across the field behind him. Another round shot went close enough to Sharp to sound like a sudden harsh whip-cracking wind, and if the balls had been fired higher still, the sound would have rumbled like a cask being rolled over floorboards.
"You should go back to the crossroads," Sharp told Harper.
I will."
Harper did not move. The prince cantered towards the Dutch-Belgian battalions on the right-hand side of the road. He had drawn his massive sabre. He called for Rebecca to accompany him. The Baron, his eyes streaming with the hay fever, sneezed once more, and the French guns magically ceased fire. Men wounded by the cannon fire were screaming, and the band was playing, but it seemed like a rather ominous quiet. Then the French drums began.
"I never thought I'd hear old trousers being played again," Harper said wistfully.
It was the sound of French infantry being drummed to the attack. A mass of drums was being beaten, but the drummers, like the approaching infantry, were hidden by the tall crop of rye. There was something curiously menacing in the repetitive drum beats that seemed to come from nowhere. Then Sharp saw the far crops being trampled flat, and he knew that each patch of collapsing rye betrayed the advance of a French column. He counted three formations directly to the front. Each column was a solid formation of men, aimed like a battering ram at the Dutch line. A crash of musketry off to the right flank betrayed that the farms to the west were under attack, but here in the centre, where the road led enticingly to the crossroads, the enemy was still hidden. Hidden, but not silent. The drums suddenly paused, and the columns shouted their great war cry, "Vive l'Empereur!" The sound of that cheer stopped the Dutch band cold. The musicians lowered their instruments and stared into the concealing field where the rye seemed to move, as though an invisible giant's footsteps crushed it down. The French gunners opened fire again, this time using short-barreled howitzers that fired shells in a high arc over the heads of their own columns, and which exploded in small, dirty gouts of flame and smoke. The first French skirmishers were appearing at the edge of the trampled area. The Dutch skirmishers had yielded the field, retreating to their battalions. So now the scattering of enemy voltigeurs could kneel unmolested at the rise edge and fire at the waiting defenders. Men began to fall. Others screamed. Some died. The main enemy attack was still nothing but a sound of blended menace, a crashing noise in the rye, a thump of drums, and a deep-throated cheer. Rebeck galloped back towards the Dutch battery, shouting at its colonel to open fire on the concealed columns. But the colonel was staring at one of his officers, who'd been killed by a skirmisher's bullet. The officer lay on the chalky road, where his blood showed remarkably bright against the white dust. Other gunners were falling. A bullet clanged monstrously loud on a brass barrel and ricocheted up into the sky.
"Fire!"
Rebecca shouted angrily at the gunners. The artillery colonel jerked round, stared at Rebecca for an instant, then bellowed his own orders, but instead of ordering a killing volley into the tall rye, he commanded his men to retreat. The drivers whipped the horse teams onto the road while the gun crews manhandled the weapons back to hook them onto their limbers. The huge ammunition wagons set off for the crossroads, their massive iron-trimmed wheels digging great gouges into the road's surface. The gun teams began to follow, but two teams collided, their limber wheels locked, and there was a sudden tangle of cursing drivers, stalled cannon, and frightened horses. Sharp had spurred forward.
"Where are you going?"
he shouted in French across the chaos.
"Back!"
the gunner colonel shouted over the noise of an exploding howitzer shell.
"Stop at the farm! Stop at Gemiancourt!"
Sharp knew the panic could not be controlled here, where the French columns filled the air with menace. But perhaps the sturdy walls of Gemiancourt would give these gunners some necessary reassurance.
"Back! Back the gun away!"
The colonel slashed with his riding crop as he tried to disentangle the trapped limbers. Another volley of French howitzer fire miraculously missed the melee of gunners and horses, which, stung by the shell's threat, magically disentangled itself. The fleeing Dutch guns crashed up onto the road, their chains and buckets swinging. Those gunners who had no riding place on the guns or limbers were running down the verges in an undisciplined retreat. "Stop at the farm!" Sharp bellowed after the gunner colonel. An howitzer shell screamed down to smash the wheel of the last gun limber. For a second the shell lay with a smoking fuse amidst the wreckage of the wheel. Then it crashed apart in a deafening explosion. One horse died instantly, its guts flung red and wet across the road. Another screaming beast collapsed on broken hind legs. The rest of the team, panicking, tried to gallop free and only slewed the broken limber round. A gunner fell off his seat on the ammunition box and was crushed by the limber's scraping violence. He clawed at the broken wheel, at first dragged him across, then pinned him to the road. The other gunners ignored him. Instead, they slashed at the traces with swords or knives, eventually freeing the four live horses which galloped wild-eyed towards Jemiancourt. The dying horse was mercifully shot by an officer, who then took off after his men, abandoning the gun. The man under the limber was also abandoned. He was left screaming in a terrible wailing sob that made the nearest infantry look nervously round. Harper rode up to the man and saw the broken wheel spokes impaled in his belly and groin. He took the rifle off his shoulder, aimed it, and shot once. The French skirmishers cheered their victory over the panicked gun teams, then turned their muskets on the nearest Belgian battalions. The Prince of Orange was shouting at his men to stand fast, to wait. But the attrition of the skirmishers was fraying their nerves. They began to edge backwards. "They'll not stand!" Harper warned Sharp. "The buggers bloody well will!" Sharp spurred towards the nearest Belgians, but before he could even get close to the battalion, a French column burst out of the rye, and the Belgians, without even firing a volley, turned and ran. One moment they were a formed battalion, and the next they were a mob. Sharp reined in. Two howitzer shells exploded a few paces from his horse, both blasts beginning small fires among the rye. The French were cheering. The prince was hitting at the running men with the flat of his sabre, but they feared an emperor far more than they feared a prince, and so they kept on running. The other battalions were infected by the panic and also fled. The French skirmishers turned their force on the prince's staff. Rebecca, his eyes red and swollen from hay fever, reined his horse alongside Sharp. "This isn't a very impressive beginning, is it? Get out of here, sir." Sharp could hear the hiss and whiplash of musket bullets all around them. "Can you find out what's happening to Saxe of Weimar?" Rebecca asked. Sharp nodded. "I will, sir, but you go, now!" The first French skirmishers were running forward, but instead of tackling the staff officers who still lingered close to the Dutch position, they laid their hands on the abandoned gun, the first trophy of their attack. A trumpet sounded behind the column, and a Dutch aide shouted a warning of enemy cavalry. The prince turned his horse and galloped north towards Jemiancourt and Quatre Bras. Rebecca galloped after the prince, while Sharp and Harper rode west. All along the centre of the position the Dutch had collapsed, leaving a great inviting hole into which the French could swarm. Yet from the far right flank there still came the sound of reassuring volleys, proof that Saxe of Weimar's men were defending staunchly. Prince Bernhard's battalions, which had held the crossroads the night before, now protected it again. They were retreating from the French attack, but they were not running. Instead, they were marching backwards and pausing every few steps to fire steady and effective volleys at their French attackers. Those Frenchmen, Sharp noticed, had deployed from column into a line that overlapped and outnumbered Saxe of Weimar's brigade. Yet the Nassauers were fighting well. Better still, instead of retreating back to the crossroads, they were going to the cover of the dark wood, which ran like a bastion down the left flank of the French route to Quatre Bras. If the prince could hold the wood, and the centre was somehow saved, there was still a chance. It was a very slight chance, a mere wisp of straw snatched against an overwhelming disaster, for Sharp could not see how any general, let alone a pimpled prince, could reform the broken troops of the centre and stop the French from sweeping forward to take the crossroads. And once the crossroads were taken, then no British troops could reach the Prussians, and thus the armies would be irrevocably split, and the Emperor would have won his campaign. "We're going back!" Sharp shouted at Harper. They turned their horses away from Saxe of Weimar's men,
who were now edging the tree line with deadly musketry. Sharp and Harper trotted northwards, staying a few hundred yards ahead of the advancing French. To their left was the long forbidding wood with its tangle of trees and stubborn defenders. In the centre was Jemiancourt Farm, which should have been a fortress to hold up the French, but was now empty because the Belgian guns and infantry had fled straight past the farm, thus yielding its strong walls and loopholed barns to the enemy. Far ahead of Sharp was the crossroads itself, where the dark mass of fugitives was milling in confusion, while to the right, and acting somewhat as another bastion, was a smaller wood and a handful of cottages. "Look! Look!" Harper was standing in his stirrups, pointing and cheering at the smaller wood to the right. "God bless the bastards! Well done, lads!" For in that far wood which protected the road that ran towards the Prussian army were riflemen, green jackets, the best of the goddamn best. The British reinforcements had started to arrive. But behind Sharp and Harper, the victorious French marched on, and between them and the crossroads, there was nothing. Chapter 8. The Prince of Orange, blithely disregarding that nearly half of his troops had fled the field, greeted the Duke of Wellington with good news. "We are holding the woods," he announced in a tone that implied victory was thereby guaranteed. The Duke, returning from Ligny, where the Prussians waited for Napoleon's attack, cast a cold eye on the fugitives who streamed northwards towards Brussels, then turned a grave face on the excited prince. "The woods?" The Duke's polite request for a more precise report was icy. "Over there," the prince pointed vaguely towards the right flank. "Isn't that so, Rebecca?" Rebecca deferred to Sharp, who had actually visited the right flank. "Prince Bernhard's brigade retreated into the woods, sir. They're holding the tree line." The Duke nodded curt acknowledgement, then urged his horse a few paces forward so he could survey the ruin he had inherited from the Prince of Orange. The Belgian troops had been driven from all the forward farms, and even more disastrously had failed to garrison Jemiancourt. French cavalry, artillery, and infantry had already advanced as far as the stream, and it could only be a matter of moments before they thrust a strong attack at the vital crossroads. The only good news was that Prince Bernhard of Saxe-Weimar's men held the woods on the right, thus denying the French the shelter of the trees as they attacked the crossroads. But that slim advantage would count for nothing unless the Duke could construct another defensive line to protect the highway. The materials for that line were at last arriving. The riflemen that Harper had seen were the vanguard of Sir Thomas Picton's 5th Division. The rest of that division was now marching through the crossroads and past the remnants of the dispirited Belgians. "I promised Blücher we'd march to his aid," the Duke greeted Sir Thomas Picton, "but only if we weren't attacked here." A French gun fired a ranging shot from Jemiancourt, and the ball skipped off the road, passed the Duke, and crashed into a wall of the farm at the crossroads. "It seems the Prussians will have to fight without us today," the Duke said dryly, then gestured towards the fields which lay to the left of Quatre Bras. "Your men to line the road there, Sir Thomas, with your right flank in front of the crossroads." Lieutenant General Sir Thomas Picton, a burly and bad-tempered man who had fought gallantly through Spain, glared at the Duke. "I'll not take orders from that bloody little Dutch boy." "You will take orders from me, Picton, and not from His Royal Highness, I quite agree. May I trouble you now to obey those orders?" Picton, dressed in a top hat and a civilian coat that looked like a farmer's cast-off, obeyed. His infantry marched through the disorganized Dutch battalions and took their station just south of the Nivelle Road. Closest to the crossroads was the 92nd, a Highland battalion in kilts, cath-dath hose, and black-plumed bonnets. Next to them were more Highlanders, the 42nd, or Black Watch, who wore a dark plaid and red hackles, and whose officers flaunted vultures' feathers in their caps and carried lethal broadswords. Next to them were the 44th, the East Essex, placid countrymen in coats of yellow-faced scarlet.
All three battalions were veterans, immune to French drums and French cheers, and content to smoke their short clay pipes as they waited to see what the day would bring from the long fields of rye. The French batteries had been moved forward from Frasne to the slopes above Gemiancourt. Their gunners now made the last adjustments to their cannons' elevating screws, while the infantry, which had taken the battlefield centre with scarce a scratch to themselves, rested in the rye. The French seemed to have no sense of urgency, perhaps believing the battle for Quatre Bras already won. 7 miles to the east, another and larger battle had begun, evidenced by the sudden and overwhelming sound of cannon salvos that rolled and punched across the intervening countryside. The Emperor had launched his attack on the Prussians. The first batteries of British artillery reached Quatre Bras and were ordered to unlimber at the crossroads. Almost immediately the gunners came under strong musket fire from French skirmishers who had crept forward in the long rye. The enemy voltigeurs were especially thick in the wedge of field between the highway and the woods where Saxe Weimar's men kept up their stubborn resistance. The Highlanders sent their light companies forward to beat back the French. Sharp was a skirmisher himself, and he watched the light company's battle with a professional eye. The job of the skirmisher was simple enough. A battle line was a mass of close-packed men who could fire a deadly weight of metal in disciplined volleys. But to upset those men and thin their ranks, the skirmishers were sent ahead like a swarm of wasps to sting and unsettle them. The best way to defeat the skirmishers was with other skirmishers, the two swarms meeting in a private battle between the lines. It was a battle that the British were accustomed to winning against the French, but today the French seemed to have deployed far more skirmishers than usual. The Highlanders made a spirited attack, but were held up at the field's margin by the sheer weight of French musket fire that smoked and flickered out of the rye. "There's thousands of the buggers!" Harper had never seen a French skirmish line so overwhelming in numbers. "I thought you were staying out of trouble." Sharp had to raise his voice over the sound of the French fire. "I am." "Then get back." Even more French skirmishers were pushing forward, so that all along the line of Picton's division the redcoats were falling, and the sergeants had begun their litany of battle. "Close up! Close up!" The light companies were helpless against such a horde of enemy skirmishers. Twice the Duke sent whole battalions forward in line to sweep the French voltigeurs away. But as soon as the British battalion resumed its station, the enemy skirmishers crept back, and their musket smoke blossomed again from the rye's margin. The cartridge wadding from the French guns had begun small fires in the dry crops. The flames crackled palely in the strong sunlight, adding yet more smoke to the thickening cloud of powder smoke. Cavalry reached the crossroads. They came down the Nivelle Road in a cheerful jungle of curb chains. The horsemen were Dutch, Belgians, and Brunswickers. The black-coated Brunswickers were commanded by their own Duke, who led a charge into the wedge of field that lay to the west of the highway. The French skirmishers fled the Duke of Brunswick's sabres like mice fleeing a scourge of cats, but then the Death's Head horsemen came across a French infantry brigade that was concealed in the tall crops beyond the stream. The brigade had formed squares and blasted the German horsemen with volleys of musket fire, so that the cavalry milled about in confusion, men and horses dropping, until, bleeding and balked, they were forced to retire. Some galloped for safety into the wood, others retreated through the rye to the crossroads. The Duke of Brunswick was dead. The Prince of Orange had been inspired by the success of the Brunswickers. He galloped past Sharp.
"Come on, Sharp, come on, that's the way to clear them off."
"Stay here," Sharp warned Harper, then kicked his heels back to follow the Prince, who was eagerly ordering his own newly arrived cavalry into two ranks. The black-coated Brunswickers, some with bloodied sabres, reinforced the Dutch Belgians, who followed their prince out into the wide expanse of field, where the French skirmishers still raked the redcoats with musket fire. The prince had drawn his ivory-hilted sabre, which he now waved above his head, as a signal for the two lines to quicken into a trot. The horses plunged into the smoking rye. The French skirmishers, rightly terrified of the curved blades, fled precipitately, and the British infantry cheered as their tormentors were driven away. Sharp rode with Rebec and the other staff officers between the two Dutch ranks, while the prince cantered ahead of the horsemen. The prince was happy. This was war. He had been cheered by the redcoats, proof that his heroism was appreciated. His horse curvetted prettily, and the sun reflected off his sabre's polished blade. The French skirmishers were running in terror from him, fleeing like game from the beaters. And in a moment he would order the full gallop, and he imagined the thrill of breaking through the enemy lines, then sabring the gunners and pouncing on the French baggage. Europe would learn that a new military power had arisen. William, Prince of Orange. Still, the swarm of French skirmishers retreated before the prince. A few Frenchmen stopped to fire at their pursuers, but they dared not pause long for fear of the sabres, and thus their wild shooting did no damage. The fleeing Frenchmen splashed through the stream and ran past Gemiancourt Farm. There seemed to be no French columns ahead, just the inviting field of rye climbing to the low crest, where the French gunners waited to be cut down by the prince's sabres. Lieutenant Doggett, riding next to Sharp, nervously drew his sword. "I've never fought on horseback."
"Just concentrate on staying in the saddle and try not to chop your horse's ears off."
"Yes, sir."
Doggett gave his horse's ears a rather speculative look. "Don't chop with your sword," Sharp continued his last-minute tuition, "but stab with it, and keep your horse moving. If you stand still in a melee, you'll be dead."
"Yes, sir."
The prince seemed to have no fear, but trotted through the ford straight towards the French guns, which stood silent on the skyline. He was wondering why he'd not thought to have had a huge banner of orange silk made, a banner that would follow him on a battlefield to terrify the enemy. He turned to look for Rebec, intending to order the chief of staff to have just such a banner made, but instead he saw that the entire first rank of his horsemen had come to an ignominious halt at the far bank of the stream.
"Come on!" the prince shouted at them. "Follow me!"
Not a man nor a horse moved, and the second rank of horsemen stopped, a few paces behind the first. The prince turned back to his front and saw why. A brigade of French light cavalry had appeared beside the enemy guns. The enemy horsemen were lancers and hussars, gaudy in green, scarlet, and blue, who now spread ahead of the cannons to make their own two lines of attack. The French standard-bearers carried guidon flags, while each lancer had a small red and white swallow-tailed flag attached just beneath his weapon's slender blade. The French cavalry were outnumbered by the prince's force, but they still advanced with a jaunty confidence. It would be sabre against sabre, and sabre against lance. The French came to a halt 200 yards from the immobile Dutch cavalry. The lancers formed the front rank, while the hussars reined in 50 paces behind. For a few seconds the two bodies of cavalry just stared at each other, then the prince raised his heavy sabre high over his head. "Charge!" He shouted it in a fine, loud voice. At the same instant he spurred forward and lowered his sabre's point, but then realized that his men had not moved from the stream bank. The staff officers had dutifully begun to follow the prince, but the Belgian horsemen had stayed obstinately still. "Charge!" the prince shouted again, but again no one moved. Some officers tried to urge their men forward, but those few who were forced ahead soon pulled aside and stopped again.
"Bloody hell!"
Sharp drew his sword, then looked at Simon Doggett. "In a few seconds, Lieutenant, this is going to be a goddamn bloody shambles. Ride like hell for the crossroads when it starts. Don't look back, don't slow down, and don't try and play games with lancers."
"Yes, sir."
Doggett glanced left and right, but the Belgians would not close on the Frenchmen. Just a year ago, these Belgians had been a part of the French army, and they had no wish to kill their old comrades. Some of the Belgian horsemen pulled their horses' heads round to demonstrate their unwillingness to charge. The French horses snorted, tossed their heads, and trampled the rye. The lancers held their 8-foot-long weapons vertically so that the red and white flags made a brave show against the sky. Sharp hated lances. He had been captured at Lance Point in India and still bore the scar on his chest. Some men preferred fighting lances to sabres, claiming that once the lance point was evaded, the lancer was dead meat. But Sharp had never felt easy facing the razor-sharp and narrow-bladed spears.
Then, with a deliberate slow menace, and apparently without any order being given, the whole front rank of the French cavalry swung their lance points down into the charge. The sight of the blades dropping was enough for the Belgian horsemen. They wrenched their horses about, rammed back their spurs, and fled. The staff officers tried to rally the nearest horsemen, but it was hopeless. Sharp pulled Doggett's bridle round. "Get out of here! Ride!" The prince had already fled. Rebecca was staring at the enemy through eyes made swollen and watery by hay fever. A French bugle sounded loud and mocking, starting the lancers on their pursuit. "Come on, Sharp!" Rebecca shouted. Sharp had already turned his horse. He saw the prince ahead of him, head down, galloping. He spurred his own horse, hearing the crash of the galloping enemy horses behind. The enemy's trumpet calls filled the sky with threat. It was a race. The quickest of the French horses swiftly overtook the slower Belgians. Lances were drawn back and thrust forward into unprotected backs. Men screamed, arched their spines, and fell. Hooves drummed up great chunks of soil. A Dutchman cut blindly at a lancer, and to his own surprise knocked the man backwards from his saddle. A bleeding horse limped. A Brunswicker tumbled from his saddle, scrambled to his feet, and was immediately cut down by an hussar's sabre. The hussars were catching up with the slower Dutch-Belgian horsemen now, and their sabres slashed into necks and laid open ribs. Blood slicked the rye straw. Hundreds of broken Dutch-Belgian horsemen streamed northwards towards the crossroads, and the enemy rode among them, screaming to keep the panic bubbling, killing and slashing when they could. The Duke of Wellington rode forward to stop the rout, but the Dutch-Belgian cavalry ignored him, parting about his staff in a flood of sweating horses and frightened men. The French were racing up behind and on the flanks. "Get back, sir!" a staff officer shouted at the Duke, who still swore and shouted at the panicked Belgians. All the Duke could see was a chaos of dust, burning rye, blood, and frightened horsemen, until, clear in the panicked swirl, he suddenly saw the bright gleam of French helmets and lance blades. The Duke turned his horse and spurred hard. There was no escape on the road, for that was crowded with fugitives, so instead he galloped straight towards the solid ranks of the 92nd. There were Frenchmen to his left and right, trying to cut ahead of the Duke. Two lancers were behind, rowelling their horses' flanks bloody in an attempt to reach him. Copenhagen, the Duke's horse, named for one of his early victories, stretched out his neck. The Highlanders were in four standing ranks that bristled with bayonets. No horse would charge home into such a thickly packed formation. But the Duke was shouting at the Scotsmen, "Down! Down! Down!" Four files of men dropped to the ground. Copenhagen gathered himself, jumped, and the Duke sailed safely over the 16 crouching men. "Fire!" a Highlander officer shouted, and a volley of musketry slashed into the French pursuers. The two lancers died instantly, their horses flailing bloodily along the ground almost to the feet of the front rank. "Reload!" The officer who shouted the fire orders had been one of the men dancing above the crossed swords in the Duchess's ballroom the night before. "Fire!" An hussar's face disappeared in blood as his wounded horse reared. Man and beast fell screaming into the path of a galloping lancer. The lance's horse tumbled, legs breaking, while its rider sprawled unhurt. The lance, driven deep into the soil, quivered. "Reload!" the Scots officer shouted. A mixture of French and Dutch-Belgian cavalry galloped at the infantry line. The Belgians, desperate for safety, spurred through the gaps between the battalions, and the French horsemen rode with them. The redcoats suddenly realized that there were enemy horsemen in their rear. The Black Watch was ordered to form square. The wings of the battalion curved backwards and inwards, but the enemy lancers were already behind the line and spurring into the space between the wings. They saw the Scottish colors and rammed their lances forward at the men who protected the great silk banners. Two Scottish officers faced them on horseback. One lancer went down under a claymore's strike, his skull split down to his coat collar. Colonel Macara was shouting at his flanks to close, and by sheer brute strength the two ends of the line forced themselves inwards to make a crude square. A dozen enemy lancers were trapped inside the formation. One lunged at the colonel, but Macara knocked the lance aside, then rammed his claymore forward.
Platoon, fire!" he shouted, while his sword was still killing the lancer. Other lancers were being dragged from their saddles by vengeful Scottish soldiers who stabbed down with bayonets. Outside the square, the horsemen veered away from the platoon volleys, while inside the square the trapped lancers were butchered. The colours were safe, and the pipes had never stopped playing. The neighbouring battalion, the East Essex, stayed in their line. They, like the Scots, had been in four ranks, but their colonel simply turned his rear rank about and opened fire front and rear, killing Dutch, Belgians and French horsemen indiscriminately. One band of determined French cavalry spurred hard from the rear in a furious attempt to capture the battalion's colours. The spears chopped down two British sergeants. A sabre slashed a redcoat aside. Then a lancer rammed his long blade into the eye of the ensign carrying the regimental flag. Ensign Christie fell, but he held tight to the big yellow silk banner as he collapsed. Two hussars attacked the fallen Christie, leaning down from their saddles to hack at the 16-year-old with their sabres. Redcoats scrambled forward, climbing over their own dead and wounded. A lancer tried to pick up the colour with his weapon's point, but Christie hung on grimly. The two hussars grunted as they chopped at him with their sabres. A musket shot killed one Frenchman. The other parried a bayonet thrust, then stabbed down at Christie a last time. Another musket hammered, and the hussar was plucked out of his saddle like a puppet jerked on strings. A knot of red-coated officers and men surged over the prone Christie, driving the last enemy away. A lancer had speared a corner of the flag, and now jerked his lance up to tear a fragment of the yellow silk away. But even that trophy was denied the French. Three muskets flamed, and the lancer toppled backwards from his horse. "Close up! Close up!" the sergeant shouted. A crashing volley cleared a space in front of the battalion. The air was thick with the foul powder smoke, rank with the stench of blood, and loud with the noise of screaming horses and men. A loose horse galloped wildly across the face of the line, streaming blood. A lancer staggered away on foot and was dropped by a musket bullet. The French horsemen were turning and riding away, trying to escape the musket volleys. Ensign Christie was alive, still with the colour gripped to his body that had been slashed with more than 20 sabre and lance wounds. His men made a litter of muskets and blankets, and carried him back to the surgeons who had set up for business in the barn by the crossroads. The colour, its bright yellow silk slashed by steel and stained with Christie's blood, was raised again. The French cavalry, like an ebbing tide of blood, reformed a quarter mile away. The crossroads had held. The Black Watch dragged the dead lancers from inside their square and dumped the bodies as a kind of rampart to trip any more charging horses. Men reloaded their muskets. The wounded limped back to the surgeons. One man fell to his knees, vomited blood, then collapsed. The French had come perilously close to breaking the British line apart. Some of the hussars and lancers, who had ridden to the rear of the red-coated battalions, had galloped along the road they were trying to capture, and had only retreated back through the intervals between the battalions because there were not enough horsemen to hold the temporarily captured road. It now seemed to the French that one more effort would surely succeed, and that the red-coated infantry would break, just like the Dutch-Belgian horsemen had broken. The trumpets screamed for that second effort, which, to ensure success, was strengthened with 800 cuirassiers, the confrères, big brothers of the French army. The cuirassiers wore steel breastplates, helmets, and backplates, and rode the heaviest horses of all the French cavalry. A big brother, his armour and his horse, weighed more than a ton. The confrères, their armoured steel reflecting the sun like silver fire, would lead the second charge and crush the infantry by sheer weight and terror. But the infantry, expecting the charge, was ready. The musket volleys crashed smoke and flame, and punched their bullets clear through the armour plate. The cuirassiers were tumbled down to the crushed rye as the musket volleys settled into their killing rhythm. Dying horses quivered on the compacted rye, while wounded cuirassiers struggled to unburden themselves of helmets and armour before limping away. The lancers and hussars, seeing the slaughter of the armoured horsemen, did not press their own charge home. "Cease fire! Reload!" the officers and sergeants called to the British squares. The regimental bands played on, while in the squares the colours hung heavy in the humid and smoke-stained air. The enemy cavalry, blooded and beaten, pulled back to the stream. From the east came the sound of cannon, proof that the Prussians still fought their battle. Then the French skirmishers crept forward and opened their galling fire again, and from beyond Gemiancourt the French 12-pounder cannons opened fire on the British ranks. The enemy cavalry was still in sight, and not so very far off, and so the infantry was forced to stay in their squares as prime targets for the heavy French cannon. It was time for the infantry to suffer. On the roads leading to Quatre Bras from the west and north, the hurrying British troops saw the growing canopy of smoke and heard the incessant punch of the heavy guns. Carts were already travelling back to Brussels carrying wounded men, who groaned in the afternoon heat, while their blood dripped through the bottom boards to stain the white road red. Other wounded men walked away from the battle, staggering in the sun towards their old bivouac areas. In Nivelles, the townspeople huddled at their doors, listened to the noise of battle, and stared wide-eyed at the foully wounded soldiers who limped past. Some unwounded Belgian soldiers spread the news that the British were already beaten, and that the Emperor was already on his way to Brussels. The clouds thickened in the west, climbing ever higher and darker. 12 miles to the north of Quatre Bras, in the orchard of a farm called Hougoumont, which in turn was close to the small village of Waterloo, some men were busy thinning the apple crop. They plucked the unripe fruit and tossed it into baskets, thus ensuring that the remaining apples would grow big and juicy. The discarded fruit would be fed to the pigs that lived in the yard of the chateau of Hougoumont. It was a hot day, and as the men worked they could hear the percussive thumping of the guns to the south. From the top of their ladders they could see the growing cloud of dirty smoke that climbed over the battlefield. They chuckled at the sight, relieved that it was not they who were being shot at, nor their homes being invaded by soldiers, and not their land being ridden ragged by cavalry. The chateau windows were open, and white curtains stirred in the small breeze that offered a slight measure of relief from the stifling heat. A plump woman came to one of the upstairs windows, where she rested her arms on the sill and stared at the strange conical smoke canopy that grew in the far southern sky. On the main highway that ran through the valley east of the chateau, she could see a stream of soldiers marching south. The men wore red, and even at this distance she could see they were hurrying. "Better them than us, eh, ma'am?" one of the apple pickers shouted.
"Better them than us?"
the woman agreed, then crossed herself. "We'll get rain tomorrow," one of the men remarked. But the others took no notice. They were too busy picking apples. Tomorrow, if it did not rain, they were supposed to finish the haymaking down in the valley's bottom, and there was a flock of sheep to be sheared as well. While the day after tomorrow, thank the good Lord, they would have a day off, because it was Sunday. More British troops arrived at Quatre Bras, but they had to be sent to the flanks, which were under increasing pressure from the French. Sharp, after scraping home in front of the French cavalry, had been sent through the wood to find Prince Bernhard of Saxe-Weimar. The prince, a dour, tough man, had been holding his position, but his ammunition was running low and his men were being killed by the ever-present skirmishers. Newly arrived British infantry were sent to support him, while yet more redcoats were sent to help the rifles on the left flank, who were also under heavy attack from a brigade of French infantry. "Why don't they attack our center with infantry?" Doggett asked Sharp, who had rejoined Harper behind the crossroads.
"Because they're being led by a cavalryman."
An Hussar prisoner had revealed that it was Marshal Ney who led the French troops at Quatre Bras. Ney was called the bravest of the brave, a red-haired cavalryman who would have ridden through the pits of hell without a murmur, but who had yet to launch an infantry attack against the battered defenders at the crossroads.
"You have to understand something about cavalrymen, Mr. Doggett," Harper explained. "They look very fine, so they do, and they usually take all the credit for any victory, but the only brains they've got are the ones they keep in their horses' heads."
Doggett blushed.
"I wanted to be a cavalryman, but my father insisted I join the guards."
"Don't worry," Harper said cheerfully. "The guards aren't our brightest lads either. God save Ireland, but just look at those poor boys."
The poor boys were the Highlanders beyond the crossroads, who could only stand and be slaughtered by the French guns. They were in square, which made them a tempting target for the French artillerymen, and they dared not relinquish the formation for fear of the French cavalry that watched them like hawks. The Scotsmen could only stand while the round shot slammed into the files, and each shot that struck home killed two or three men, sometimes more. Once Harper saw a round shot strike the flanking face of a square, and 10 men went down in a single bloody smear. The British artillery at the crossroads was being saved for any French infantry attack, though once in a while a gun would try to hit a French cannon. Such counter-battery fire was almost always wasted, but as the infantry's suffering dragged on, the Duke ordered more of it simply to help the morale of the redcoats.
"Why don't we do something?"
Doggett asked plaintively.
"What's to do?" Harper asked. "The bloody Belgians won't fight, so we haven't got any cavalry. It's called being an infantryman, Mr. Doggett. Your job is to stand there and get slaughtered."
"Patrick," Sharp had been staring up the Nivelle Road, "do you see what I see?"
Harper twisted in his saddle. "Bloody hell, sir, you're right."
A further brigade of British infantry was arriving, and among the troops was the Prince of Wales's own volunteers. Sharp and Harper spurred towards their old battalion. Sharp stood his horse beside the road and took off his hat as the leading company came abreast. It was his old company, the Light, led by Peter D'Alembourg. The men's faces were pale with dust, through which the rivulets of sweat had driven dark trails. Daniel Hagman raised a cheer as Sharp tossed them a full canteen of water. D'Alembourg, his white dancing breeches stained from the wax with which his saddle had been polished, reined in beside the two riflemen and looked dubiously towards the smear of smoke that marked the battlefield. "How is it?"
"It's stiff work, Peter," Sharp admitted.
"Is Burney here?"
It was the same question that nearly every newly arriving officer had asked, as though the presence of the Emperor would dignify the day's death and dismemberment.
"Not so far as we know."
Sharp saw that his answer disappointed D'Alembourg. The brigade halted while Sir Colin Halkett, its commander, discovered where his four battalions were wanted. Lieutenant Colonel Ford and his two majors, Vine and Micklewhite, walked their horses up the road until they came close to where Sharp, D'Alembourg, and Harper chatted. Ford, myopically peering towards the cannon smoke, realized too late that he'd come close to Sharp, whose presence made him feel so uncomfortable and inadequate. But he put a brave face on the chance meeting.
"It sounds brisk, Sharp, does it not?"
"It's certainly hard work, Ford," Sharp said mildly.
No one seemed to be able to find anything else to say. Ford smiled with a general benignity which he thought fitting to a colonel, while Major Vine scowled at the men of the Prince of Wales's own volunteers who had slumped on the roadside, and Major Micklewhite pretended to be enthralled by the enamel picture on the lid of his snuff-box. A sudden explosion was loud enough to penetrate the half-deaf ears of Major Vine, who twisted round to see that a British gun limber, crammed with ready ammunition, had been struck by a French shell and was now spewing a thick skein of smoke and flames into the sky. Colonel Ford had jumped at the sudden violence of the explosion, and now he gazed through his thick spectacles at the rest of the battlefield, which appeared as a threatening blur of trampled corn, blood, smoke, and the lumped bodies of the dead. Cannonballs were ploughing through the slurry of rye and soil, spewing gouts of earth before bouncing into the bloody lines of Highlanders.
"Dear God," Ford said, with rather more feeling than he had intended.
"Watch out for their skirmishers," Sharp advised dryly. "They seem to have more of the bastards than usual."
"More?"
The tone to Ford's voice betrayed the colonel's fear of taking his battalion into the cauldron beyond the crossroads.
"You might like to think about deploying an extra company as skirmishers."
Sharp, well aware of Ford's uncertainty, offered the advice as forcefully as he could, without sounding patronizing.
"But warn the lads to keep an eye open for the cavalry. They're never very far away."
Sharp pointed across the highway, to where the stream fed a small lake behind Gemiancourt Farm.
"There's a fold in the ground over there, and it's swarming with the evil buggers."
Quite so.
Ford took off his spectacles, cleaned them on the tasseled end of his red sash, then hooked the earpieces back into place. He stared through the newly cleaned glass, but could see neither a fold in the ground nor any cavalry.
He wondered whether Sharp was deliberately trying to frighten him, and so, to show that he was quite equal to the prospect of fighting, Ford straightened his shoulders and turned his horse away. Vine and Micklewhite, like obedient hounds, followed their colonel.
"He won't take a blind bit of notice," Dalimbor sighed.
"Then you watch out for the cavalry, Peter. They're in something of a murderous bloody mood. There's about 3,000 of the bastards, hussars, lancers, and the heavies."
"You do cheer me up, Sharp, you really do."
Dalimbor superstitiously touched the breast pocket, which bulged with his fiancée's letters.
"Have you had your note from that bloody man yet?"
It took Sharp a second or two to realize that Dalimbor was talking about Lord John Rossendale. He shook his head.
"Not yet."
"Oh, God. I says that means we'll have to arrange a duel in the morning."
"No, I'll just find the bugger and cut his balls off."
"Oh, splendid," Dalimbor said in mock seriousness. "That should satisfy everyone's honor."
Orders came back to the battalion. The newly arrived brigade was to take up positions in the wedge of field in front of Saxe-Weimar's wood, from where their musket fire could rake across the flank of any French attack down the road. Sir Thomas Picton's staff brought the orders which insisted that the four battalions were to form square in the rye. Sharp shook Dalimbor's hand.
"Watch those skirmishers, Peter."
He waved to Captain Harry Price, who had once been his lieutenant.
"It's hot work, Harry."
"I'm thinking of resigning, sir."
Harry Price, too poor to own a horse, was sweating from the exertions of his long day's march.
"My father always wanted me to take holy orders, and I'm beginning to think I rejected his views too quickly."
"Good God, it's Mr. Harper."
Harper grinned.
"Good to see you, Mr. Price."
"I thought the army had discharged you."
"It did."
"You're as mad as a bloody bishop. What are you doing here?"
Harry Price was genuinely puzzled.
"You could get hurt, you damned fool."
"I'm staying well out of any trouble, so I am."
Price shook his head at Harper's foolishness, then had to hurry away as the battalion was ordered into the wood. The companies filed through the trees and so out into the sunlit rye field, where, like the other three battalions in Halkett's brigade, they formed square. Sharp and Harper walked their horses back to the crossroads, where the Prince of Orange was fidgeting with the ivory hilt of his sabre. He was frustrated by the day's setbacks. He had seen his infantry crumple at the first French attack, then watched his cavalry flee at the drop of a lance point. Yet he blamed the day's lack of success on anyone but himself or his countrymen.
"Look at those men, for instance."
He pointed towards the four battalions of Halkett's brigade, which had just formed their squares on the flank of the wood.
"It's a nonsense to form those men in square. A nonsense."
The prince turned irritably, looking for a British staff officer.
"Sharp, you explain it to me. Why are those men in square?"
"Too many cavalry, sir."
Sharp explained gently.
"I see no cavalry."
The prince stared across the smoke-shrouded battlefield.
"Where are the cavalry?"
"Over there, sir."
Sharp pointed across the field. "There's a lake to the left of the farm, and they're hidden there. They've probably dismounted so we can't see them, but they're there, sure enough."
"You're imagining it."
Since losing his Belgian cavalry, the prince had been given nothing to do, and he felt slighted. The Duke of Wellington was ignoring him, reducing the prince to the status of an honoured spectator. Well, damn that. There was no glory to be had in just watching a battle from behind a crossroads. He looked back at the newly deployed brigade that stood in its four battalion squares.
"What brigade is that?"
he asked his staff. Rebecca raised an eyebrow at Sharp, who answered,
"The 5th Brigade, sir."
"Halkett's, you mean?"
The prince frowned at Sharp.
"Yes, sir."
"They're in my corps, aren't they?"
the prince demanded. There was a brief silence, then Rebecca nodded.
"Indeed they are, sir."
The prince's face showed outrage.
"Then why wasn't I consulted about their placement?"
No one wanted to answer, at least not with the truth, which was that the Duke of Wellington did not trust the prince's judgment. Rebecca just shrugged, while Sharp stared at the smoke of the French guns. Harry Webster, beyond Rebecca, looked at his watch, while Simon Doggett slowly moved his horse back, till he had left the group of embarrassed staff officers and was next to Harper's horse. The prince drew his sabre a few inches, then rammed it back into his scabbard.
"No one gives orders to my brigades without my permission."
"When I was in the ranks, Mr. Doggett, we had a way of dealing with young gentlemen like His Royal Highness,"
Harper said quietly.
"You did? We shot the little buggers.
Harper smiled happily. Doggett stared into the battered and friendly face.
You did? Especially buggers like him.
Harper nodded scornfully towards the prince.
He's nothing but a silk stocking full of shit.
Doggett stared in horror at Harper. Doggett's sense of propriety, as well as his natural respect for royalty, were outraged by the Irishman's words.
You can't say things like that, he blurted out. He's royalty. A silk stocking full of shit with a crown, then.
Harper was quite unmoved by Doggett's outrage.
And if the little bugger doesn't watch out, Mr. Sharp will feed his guts to the hogs. It wouldn't be the first time he's done it.
Murdered someone?
Doggett blurted out the question. Harper turned innocent eyes on the guard's lieutenant.
I know for a fact he's rid the word of some bad officers. We all have. Don't be shocked, Mr. Doggett. It happens all the time.
I can't believe it,
Doggett protested, but too loudly, for the sound of his voice made the prince turn irritably in his saddle.
Is something offending you, Mr. Doggett?
No, sir.
Then get back here where you belong.
The prince looked back to the four battalions of Halkett's brigade, which were an itch to his wounded self-esteem. Closest to the crossroads and just forward of the Highlanders across the highway was a battalion of Lincolnshire men, the 69th, who were unknown to Sharp. They had never fought in Spain. Instead, they had been a part of the disastrous expedition that had failed to free the Netherlands at the end of the previous war. Beyond them was the 30th, the 310s, a Cambridgeshire battalion which, like the 33rd next in line, had also been a part of the Dutch debacle. Further south was the Prince of Wales's own volunteers, the only veterans of the Spanish campaign in the brigade.
So who ordered them to form square?
The prince demanded petulantly. No one knew, so Harry Webster was sent to discover the answer and came back after 10 minutes to say that Sir Thomas Picton had deployed the brigade.
But they're not in Picton's division.
The prince's pique had turned to a real anger that flushed his sallow face.
Indeed not, sir, Rebecca said gently.
But nothing, Rebecca, but bloody nothing. Those men are in my corps. Mine. I do not give orders to brigades in Sir Thomas Picton's division, nor do I expect him to interfere with my corps. Sharp, my compliments to Sir Colin Halkett and instruct him to deploy his brigade in line. Their task is to give fire, not cower like schoolboys from non-existent cavalry.
The prince had taken a sheet of paper from his sabretache and was scribbling the order in pencil. But the cavalry, Sharp began to protest.
What cavalry?
The prince made a great fuss of pretending to stare across the battlefield.
There's no cavalry.
In the dead ground over...
You're frightened of unseen horsemen on the left, but this brigade is on the right. Here, take this.
He thrust the written order at Sharp.
No, sir, Sharp said.
The bulbous eyes swiveled to stare in amazement at Sharp. Rebecca hissed a warning at the rifleman, while the other staff officers held their breath. The prince licked his lips.
What did you say, Sharp?
His voice was filled with horror and revulsion.
I'm not taking that order, sir. You'll kill every man jack of that brigade if you insist on it.
For a second, the prince literally shook with rage.
Are you refusing to obey an order?
I'm refusing to take that order, sir, yes.
Rebecca, suspend Colonel Sharp from his duties. Have this order sent immediately.
You can't, Sharp began.
But Rebecca seized Sharp's bridle and tugged his horse out of the prince's reach.
Rebecca, for God's sake, Sharp protested.
He's entitled, Rebecca insisted. Listen, but tomorrow he'll have forgotten this. Give him an apology tonight and you won't be suspended.
He's a good-hearted man. I don't give a damn for his heart, Rebecca. It's those men I care about.
Rebecca!
The prince turned petulantly in his saddle.
Has that order gone?
Immediately, sir.
Rebecca shrugged at Sharp, then turned away to find another officer to carry the prince's command. The order was sent. Sir Colin Halkett rode back to the prince's command post vehemently to protest the command, but the prince would not be denied. He insisted that there was no danger of a French cavalry attack and that, by deploying in square, the brigade was sacrificing 3/4 of the firepower that might be needed to rake the flank of a French infantry attack.
We mustn't be cautious,
the prince lectured the experienced Sir Colin.
"Caution won't win battles, only daring. You will form line. I insist you form line."
Sir Colin rode unhappily away, while Sharp, goaded beyond endurance by the prince's crowing voice, spurred forward. "Sir," he said to the prince. The prince ignored him. Instead, he looked at Winkler, one of his Dutch aides, and deliberately spoke in English.
"I can't think why the Duke called his men the scum of the earth, Winkler. I think he must have meant his officers, don't you?"
"Yes, sir."
Winkler, a sycophantic man, smiled. Sharp ignored the provocation.
"Permission to rejoin my old battalion, sir?"
The prince gave the smallest, curtest nod. Sharp turned his horse away and spurred it forward. Hooves sounded loud behind him, making him twist in his saddle.
"I thought you promised Isabella you'd stay out of trouble."
"There isn't any trouble yet," Harper said. "When there is, I'll get the hell out of it, but till then I'll keep you company."
Harper followed Sharp down the bank onto the Nivelle Road, where Sharp exploded in rage. "Bastard! What a cretinous, dirty-minded little Dutch bastard! I'd like to ram his pox bloody crown up his royal ass." Instead, Sharp snatched the tricorn hat off his head and ripped the black, gold and scarlet cockade of the Netherlands from its crown. He hurled the silken scrap into a patch of nettles. "Bastard!" Harper just laughed. They scrambled up the bank into the trampled field of rye. To their right, the trees were heavy with leaf, though here and there a splintered branch showed where a French cannonball or shell had struck high. There was not much litter in this part of the field, merely the corpses of two dead voltigeurs, a scatter of dead horses, and a discarded and undamaged cuirassier's breastplate that Harper dismounted to retrieve.
"Useful, that," he said, as he tied the polished piece of armor to the strap of a saddlebag.
Sharp did not reply. Instead, he watched as Sir Colin Halkett's brigade staff ordered the four battalions out of square and into line. The regimental bands played behind the brigade. Sharp saluted the colors of the 69th, the 30th, and the 33rd. He felt a particular fondness for the 33rd, the Yorkshire regiment which he had joined as a sullen youth 22 years before. He wondered if their recruiters still carried oatcakes pierced on a sword, the curious symbol he'd seen as Sergeant Hakeswell had expounded to the 16-year-old Sharp the benefits of an army life. Hakeswell was long dead, as were almost all the other men Sharp remembered from the battalion, except for the Lieutenant Colonel who had led the 33rd when Sharp had first joined, and who was now His Grace the Duke of Wellington. The 600 men of the Prince of Wales's own volunteers were deployed the furthest south, a full half-mile from the crossroads. Peter Dalembourg's skirmishers were 50 yards in front of the battalion, and having a hard time with the greater number of voltigeurs. It seemed that Ford had not taken Sharp's advice to send out extra skirmishers, but was leaving Dalembourg's men to cope as best they could. Sharp, not wanting to interfere with Ford, reined in a good 30 yards behind the battalion, close to the tree line where the battalion's band was playing. Mr. Little, the rotund bandmaster, first greeted Sharp with a cheerful grin, then with a quick and cheerful rendition of "Over the Hills and Far Away," the marching song of the Rifles. Colonel Ford, who had just finished dressing his newly formed line, turned as the music changed. He blinked with surprise to see the two riflemen, then nervously took off his spectacles and polished their round lenses on his red sash.
"Come to see us fight, Sharp?"
"I've come to see you die." But Sharp said it much too softly for anyone but Harper to hear.
"Can I suggest you form square?" he said more loudly.
Ford was clearly confused. He had only just been ordered to form the battalion into line, and now he was being asked to revert to square. He put his spectacles back into place and frowned at Sharp.
"Is that an order from brigade?"
Sharp hesitated, was tempted to tell the lie, but he had no written authority to prove the order, so he shook his head.
"Why, it's just a suggestion." "I think we'll manage quite well by following orders, Mr. Sharp."
"A pox on you, too." Again, Sharp spoke too softly for anyone but Harper to hear.
Mr. Little's band's men played merrily on while Colonel Ford took his place behind the battalion's colours, and Sharp slowly drew his long sword, which he rested on his pommel. The Prince, waiting behind the gun line at the crossroads, felt that at long last he was beginning to impose his youthful genius on the battle. On the shallow southern crest above Gemiancourt, a French cavalry scout stared in disbelief at the long, exposed line of infantrymen that had been stationed in front of the woods. He stared for a long time, seeking the implicit trap in the formation, but he could see none. He could only see men lined up for the slaughter, and so, turning his horse, he spurred towards the dead ground. While Sharp and Harper, with 2,200 men of Halkett's 5th Brigade, just waited. Chapter 9. More troops were arriving at Quatre Bras, troops who had marched till their blistered feet were agony, but who now had to plunge straight into the humid, smoke-thickened air where, unit by unit, the Duke was building the force that would counterattack the French and drive them back to Frasnes. More and more British guns crashed and jangled off the road and onto the crushed rye stalks. Fires were burning in the crops behind the French skirmishers, as British howitzer shells exploded. The battle was not won yet, but the Duke was beginning to feel like a man who had escaped defeat. He knew his guard's division was close, and there was even a rumour that the British cavalry might reach the crossroads before dark. A small west wind was stirring the thick smoke. The British skirmishers, reinforced by newly arrived battalions of light infantry, were beginning to blunt the fire of the voltigeurs. The French artillery was still taking its grievous toll of the infantry by the crossroads, but now the Duke could replace the men who fell. If Blücher held off the Emperor, and if Marshal Ney was thrown back from Quatre Bras, then in the morning the Prussians and British armies would combine, and Napoleon would have lost. The Duke opened his watch lid. It was 5:30 of a summer's evening. The battlefield was darkening, shadowed by the huge western clouds and shrouded by its pall of smoke, but plenty of daylight remained for the Duke's counterstroke. "Any news of the guards?" he asked an aide. It seemed that the guards were being apprehended by the Prince of Orange, who, as company after company of the elite troops arrived, was sending them north through the great wood to reinforce Saxe-Weimar's men. The Duke, muttering that the Prince was a bloody little boy who should be sent back to his nursery, ordered that the guards were not to be so dispersed in penny packets, but were to be held ready for his orders. "Your Grace," an aide called in warning, "enemy cavalry." The Duke turned to stare southwards. Through the smoke he saw a mass of French cavalry spurring up from dead ground and heading slantwise across the field. They were 1/2 mile away and well spread out in 4 long lines. Their loose formation made them a poor target for artillery, but the British gunners loaded with common shell and did their best. The explosions knocked down a few men and horses, but the vast mass of French cavalry trotted safely through the bursting patches of flame and smoke. The Duke extended his telescope. "Where are they going?" He was puzzled. Surely his opponent had learned by now that cavalry could achieve nothing against the stalwart squares, which had been reinforced with the newly arrived guns. "Perhaps they're testing Halkett's men," an aide suggested.
"Then they're committing suicide."
The Duke had his glass trained on the front line of cavalry that was composed of the heavy cuirassiers in their steel armour. Behind the cuirassiers were the light horsemen with their lances and sabres.
"They must be insane," the Duke opined. "Halkett's in square, isn't he?"
Almost in unison, the telescopes of the Duke's staff officers swept to the right of the field, racing past the patches of smoke to focus on the 4 battalions of Halkett's brigade, which stood in front of the wood. The brigade was obscured by cannon smoke, but there were enough rifts in the dirty screen to show that something had gone terribly wrong.
"Oh, Christ!"
the voice spoke helplessly from the Duke's entourage. There was a moment's silence, and then again,
"Oh, Christ!"
"Sir,"
Rebecca handed the prince's telescope and pointed towards Gemiancourt Farm.
There, sir.
The prince trained the heavy glass. Thousands of horsemen had appeared from the dead ground, and now, in four long lines, swept either side of the farm. Dust spurted from the road as the horsemen crashed across. The enemy cavalry was trotting, but even as the prince watched, he saw them spur into a canter. The cuirassiers had their heavy straight swords drawn. Long horsehair plumes tossed and waved from the steel brightness of their helmets. A cuirassier was hit by a British round shot, and the prince involuntarily jumped, as, magnified in his lens, the steel-clad horsemen seemed to explode in blood and metal. The lancers and hussars, cantering behind, divided to pass the butcher's mess left on the ground.
"They're going for Halkett's brigade, sir," Rebecca warned.
"Then tell Halkett to form square."
The prince's voice was suddenly high-pitched, almost sobbing.
"They've got to form square, Rebecca," he shouted, spraying Rebecca with spittle. "Tell them to form square."
"It's too late, sir. It's too late."
The French were already closer to the infantry brigade than any of the prince's staff. There was no time to send any orders. There was no time to do anything now, except watch.
"But they've got to form square,"
the prince screamed like a spoilt child.
"Too late."
The French cavalry was led by Kellerman, brave Kellerman, hero of Marengo, and veteran of 1,000 charges. In most of those charges he had led his men steadily forward, not going from the canter to the gallop till he was just a few yards from the enemy, for only by such discipline could he guarantee that his horsemen would crash in an unbroken line against the enemy. But this evening he knew that every second's delay would give the redcoats a chance to form square, and that once they were in square his horsemen were beaten. A horse would not charge a formed square with its four ranks bristling with muskets, spitting fire, and bright with bayonets. The horses would swerve round the square, receiving yet more fire from its flanks. And Kellerman had already lost too many men to the British squares this day. But these redcoats were in line. They could be attacked from their flank, from their front, and from behind, and they must not be given time to change formation, and thus Kellerman abandoned the discipline of a slow, methodical advance, and instead shouted at his trumpeters to sound the full charge. Damn the unbroken line hitting home together. Instead, Kellerman would release his killers to a bloody gallop and loose them to the slaughter.
"Charge!"
Now it was a race between cuirassiers, hussars, and lancers. The cuirassiers raked their horses' flanks and let their heavy horses run free. The lancers dropped their points and screamed their war cries. The sound of the charge was like 1,000 demented drummers, as the hooves beat the earth and churned up a mass of blood and soil and straw that flecked the sky behind the four charging lines, which slowly unraveled as the faster horses raced ahead. A cannon ball screamed between the horses, ploughed a furrow, and disappeared southwards. A lancer swerved round a dead skirmisher. The lancer's gloved hand was tight on his weapon's grip, which was made from cord lashed about the long ash staff. The lance's blade was a smooth spike of polished steel, 9 inches long and sharpened like a needle. A shell erupted harmlessly in front of the leading horsemen. The smoke of its explosion whipping back past the galloping killers. A red-plumed trumpeter played mad, wild notes. Ahead, beyond the cuirassiers, the redcoats seemed frozen in terror. This was a ride to death, to a triumph, to the glory of the best and most lethal cavalry in all the world.
"Charge!"
Kellerman bellowed. The trumpeters echoed his call, and the French torrent surged on.
"Oh God! Dear God!"
Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Ford gazed into the battlefield and saw a nightmare. The rye was filled with horsemen, and the evening light was glinting off hundreds of swords and breastplates and lance heads. Ford could hear the drumming sound of the earth being beaten by thousands of hooves, and all he could do was stare and wonder what in God's name he was supposed to do about it. A small part of his brain knew he was supposed to make a decision, but he was paralyzed.
"Cavalry!"
D'Alembert shouted unnecessarily. His skirmishers were racing back to the battalion. D'Alembert, like any good skirmish officer, had abandoned his horse to fight with his men on foot, and now he was running like a flushed hare from the threat of hunters. He could scarcely believe the speed with which the enemy horsemen had erupted from the dead ground beyond the highway.
"We should form square,"
Major Micklewhite, his horse next to Ford's, suggested to the colonel.
"Are they French?"
Ford had nervously plucked off his spectacles and was frenetically polishing their lens on his sash. For a second, Micklewhite could only gape at the colonel. He wondered why on earth Ford should suppose that British cavalry might be charging the battalion.
"Yes, sir, they're French."
Major Micklewhite's voice was edged with panic now.
"Do we form square?"
Sharp had ridden forward, taking position just behind D'Alembourg's men, who were hastily ranking themselves on the left of the battalion's line. At the right flank of the line, where the grenadier company was nearest to the French, an avalanche of cavalry was storming at the battalion's open flank. More cavalrymen were slanting into the battalion's front. To Sharp's left, beyond the 33rd, the 30th were already forming square, though the 33rd, like the Prince of Wales' own volunteers, seemed frozen in line.
"We should form square!"
Major Vine, the battalion's senior major, shouted at Ford from the right of the line.
"Get out of here, Dally!"
Sharp called to D'Alembourg, then raised his voice so all the men of the battalion could hear him.
"Run! Back to the trees! Run!"
It was too late to form square. There was only one chance of living, and that was to gain the shelter of the wood. The men, recognizing Sharp's voice, broke and fled. A few sergeants hesitated. Colonel Ford tried desperately to hook his spectacles into place.
"Form square!"
he called.
"Square!"
Major Vine yelped at the closest companies.
"Form square!
Run!"
That was Harper, once regimental sergeant major of this battalion, and still the possessor of a pair of lungs that could jar a regiment from 8 fields away.
"Run, you buggers!"
The buggers ran.
"Move, move, move!"
Sharp galloped along the front of the line, slashing with the flat of his sword to hasten the redcoats back towards the tree line.
"Run, run!"
He was racing straight towards the enemy's charge.
"Run!"
The men ran. The colour party, encumbered by the heavy squares of silk, were the slowest. One of the ensigns lost a boot and began limping. Sharp slammed his horse between the sergeants, whose long axe-bladed spontoons protected the flags, and he grabbed a handful of silk with his left hand and speared his sword into the king's colour on his right.
"Run!"
He spurred the horse, dragging the two flags behind him. The first refugees were already in the trees, where Harper was shouting at them to take firing positions. A sergeant screamed behind Sharp as a cuirassier stabbed a sword down, but the sergeant's long spontoon tripped the Frenchman's horse that sprawled down into the path of a lancer who was forced to rein in behind the thrashing beast. An hussar galloped in from the left, aiming at the colours, but Major Micklewhite slashed from horseback, and the hussar had to parry. He drove Micklewhite's light sword aside, then thrust with his sabre's point to slice Micklewhite's throat back to bone. The ensign, who had lost his boot, was ridden over by a cuirassier, whose heavy horse smashed the boy's spine with its hooves. A lance, thrown like a javelin, ripped the yellow silk of the regimental colour, then hung there to be dragged along the ground. Two more lancers spurred forward, but their attack came close to the trees where Patrick Harper lurked with his 7-barreled gun. His one shot emptied both saddles, and the very noise of the huge weapon seemed to drive the other Frenchmen away in search of easier pickings. Sharp ducked his head, struck back with his heels, and his horse crashed through a patch of ferns and into the trees. He dropped the one colour and shook the other off his sword, then wrenched the horse savagely about in expectation of French horsemen close behind. But the French had swerved away. They'd caught a handful of the slower men and cut them down, and they had killed many of the mounted officers, who had stayed behind to shelter the running redcoats. But now the French horsemen feared becoming entangled in the thick wood where the trees would blunt the force of their charge, and so they spurred on for easier prey. Behind them they left Major Micklewhite sprawled dead in a pool of his own blood. Captain Carline was dead, as were Captain Smith and 3 lieutenants, but the rest of the battalion was safe in the shelter of the wood. The 33rd, next in line to the Prince of Wales' own volunteers, had also run to the wood, while beyond them the 30th had formed a rough square that proved solid enough to stand like an island amid the torrent of French cavalry that split either side of the redcoats.
The cavalry ignored the men of the 30th because beyond their crude square, the 69th had neither run nor formed square, but was just standing in line with muskets levelled as the full might of Kellerman's cavalry, cheated of its first three targets, thundered straight for them.
"Fire!"
a major shouted. The muskets crashed smoke. 10 cuirassiers went down in a maelstrom of blood, steel, and dying horses. But there were more cuirassiers on either flank, and a rage of lancers and hussars was storming in behind the armoured vanguard. The cuirassiers hit the open flank of the 69th. A man lunged up with a bayonet, then died as the sword split his skull. The heavy horses slammed into the red ranks that broke apart like rotten wood. The infantry were scattering, thus making themselves even more vulnerable to the enemy blades. The French were in front, behind, and chewing up the battalion's flanks with slashing swords that dripped red with every grunting heave. Then the lancers struck into the shattered battalion, and the redcoats screamed as the horsemen rode clean over the breaking line. The Frenchmen were shouting incoherently. A lancer threw a corpse off his spearpoint, then stabbed again. Some infantrymen had broken free and were running to the woods, but they were easily ridden down by lancers and hussars, who galloped up behind, chose their spot, then stabbed or sliced or hacked or lunged. For the French it was no more difficult than hacking or lunging at the practice sacks of chaff with which they had been trained at their depots at home. A knot of redcoats gathered round their battalion's colours. There were sergeants with their long-shafted axes, officers with swords and men with bayonets. The French clawed and hacked the defenders. Lancers rode full tilt at them, grunting as they drove their spears home. One lance struck home with such force that the red and white flag beneath its long blade was buried in the victim's body. A dismounted cuirassier hacked at the colours' defenders till he was shot in the face by an officer's pistol. An hussar's horse reared up, hooves flailing, then lunged forward into the knot of men. Two officers went down under the slashing hooves. The hussar cut down with his sabre. A bayonet raked his left thigh, but the Frenchman did not feel the wound. His horse bit a man, the sabre hissed again. Then the hussar dropped the blade so that it hung from his wrist by its leather strap, and he grabbed the staff of one of the colours. The other colour had disappeared, but the hussar had his gloved hand round the remaining staff. Two men drove bayonets at him. A spontoon wounded his horse, but the hussar held on. A burly British sergeant tugged at the staff. A lancer crashed his horse into the melee, trampling wounded and living alike, and lunged his weapon at the stubborn sergeant. The lance point drove into the sergeant's back, but still the Englishman hung on. But then a cuirassier, riding in from the far side, hacked his sword down through the man's shako and into his skull. The sergeant fell. The hussar tugged at the colour's staff. A British major seized the colour's silk and stabbed at the hussar with the sword. But another lancer came from the right, and his blade caught the major in his belly. The major screamed, his sword dropped, and the colour came free. The hussar was bleeding from a dozen wounds. His horse was staggering and bloody, but he managed to turn the beast, and he held the British colour high above his head. The rest of the French cavalry was thundering past, charging at the crossroads where yet more infantry waited to be broken. But the hussar had his triumph. The 69th was destroyed. A few men had run to safety, and a few still lived in a pile of bodies so drenched and laced with blood that no cavalryman dreamed that any man could still be alive in the stinking heap. But the rest of the battalion had been broken and cut into ruin. Men had died at Lance Point, or been slashed open by sabres, or pierced by the long, straight swords of the cuirassiers. The battalion, which moments before had been rigid in its formal line, was now nothing but a scattered mess of bodies and blood. There were hundreds of bodies, dead, creeping, bleeding, vomiting, weeping. The cavalrymen left them, not out of pity, but because there seemed no one left to kill. It was as if a slaughterhouse had been upended on this corner of a Belgian field, leaving cuts of meat and spills of blood that steamed in the warm, humid air. The victorious cavalry charged onto the crossroads, where the newly arrived artillery greeted them with double-shotted barrels, and the infantry battalions waited in square. And thus it was the Frenchmen's turn to die.
The infantry aimed at the horses, knowing that a dead horse was a dismounted man who could be picked off afterwards. For a few moments the cavalry milled about in front of the guns and volley fire, but then Kellerman's trumpeters called for the retreat, and the French, their charge done, turned for home. Slowly the few survivors of the 69th crept from their shelter in the trees, or pushed the dead away. One man, driven to near madness by the memory of the swords and by his brother's blood that had near choked him as he lay beneath the corpse, knelt in the stubble and wept. A sergeant, holding his guts into his sabre-slashed belly, tried to walk to the rear, but fell again.
"I'm all right. I'm all right," he told a rescuer.
Another sergeant, blinded by a cuirassier and pierced in the belly by a lance, cursed. A lieutenant, his arm hanging by a shred of gristle, weaved as if drunk as he staggered among the bodies. Survivors pulled the bodies of the living and the dead away from the king's colour. Next to it was the major who had made the last despairing effort to save the regimental colour. He was dead, pierced deep through his stomach by a lance that was still embedded in his spine. The major was wearing white silk stockings and gold-buckled dancing shoes. While stuck in his Shako's badge, and strangely untouched by any of the blood which had sheeted and soaked and drenched the pile, was an ostrich feather. A soldier plucked the grey feather loose, decided it was of no value, and tossed it away. A quarter mile to the south, a bleeding French hussar on a wounded horse rode slowly back to his lines. In his right hand he carried the captured colour, which he punched again and again at the smoke-stained air, and with each triumphant punch he called aloud an incoherent shout of victory. His friends followed and applauded him. From the trees, Sharp watched the Frenchman ride south. Sharp had dismounted and was standing at the tree line with his loaded rifle. The hussar was easily within range. Harper, with his own rifle, stood beside Sharp. But neither man raised his gun. They had once come off a field of battle with an enemy colour, and now they must watch another man have his triumph.
"He'd be an officer by nightfall,"
Harper said.
"Booger deserves
it." Behind Sharp, the Prince of Wales's own volunteers were white-faced and scared. Even the veterans who had endured the worst of the Spanish battle stood silent and bitter. They were frightened, not of the enemy, but of their own officers' incompetence. Colonel Ford would not go near Sharp, but just sat his horse under the trees, and wondered why his right hand was shaking like a leaf. D'Alembert, his sword still drawn, walked up to the two riflemen. He stared past them at the captured colour of the 69th, then shook his head.
"I came to thank you. If you hadn't given the order to run, we'd be dead. And I've just been made a major."
"Congratulations."
"I'm pleased, too."
D'Alembert spoke with a bitter sarcasm. He had wanted promotion. Indeed, it was the prime reason he had stayed with the battalion. But he resented the sudden price of his majority. "You're alive, Peter," Sharp consoled his friend. "You're alive."
"The bloody man!"
D'Alembert stared savagely towards Ford.
"The bloody, bloody man! Why didn't he form square?"